Spingola. I'm coming to you from the chilly suburbs of Chicago. Thanks for joining me today on RBN for people who can handle the truth. RBN's website is republicbroadcasting.org. To see the guest lineup and relevant links for this program, please visit spingola.com. During the program, you may email your questions or comments to spingola1@yahoo.com. My regular email is deanna@spingola.com, but I do not look at that email during the program. You may join others in the chat room by clicking on the chat room button on my website, spingola.com, or by going to spingola.chatango.com. We will take calls in the second hour after we open the phone lines at 800-313-9443. My guest today is Robert Perry. His name is spelled P-A-R-R-Y. He is the author of America's Stolen Narrative, From Washington and Madison to Nixon, Reagan, and the Bushes to Obama. It was just published in October of this year, and all I've got to say about this book is, wow, it's a must-read. He is also the author of Lost History, Contras, Cocaine, The Press, and Project Truth. That came out in 1999. He also wrote Secrecy and Privilege, Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. That came out in 2004. And Neck Deep, The Disastrous Presidency of George W. Bush. And he wrote that with his two sons, Sam and Nate, or Nat. And that came out in 2007. Their website is consortiumnews.com. You can sign up to get their regular emails. Fabulous website, wonderful articles. They are running a pledge drive and would appreciate your help in that. Welcome to the program, Robert.
Thanks, Deanna. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's I started reading your book. I bought the Kindle edition, and my goodness, I was just amazed at what you talked about, particularly in Chapter 1 about the Commerce Clause, and about I just did not know about how things really went down as far as getting the Constitution together and the Articles of Confederation, and, well, it was certainly revealing and enlightening.
Thanks. That's an interesting chapter. It's sort of episodic. Obviously, you can't perhaps correct every false narrative that's sort of been inserted into the U.S. history. But I look at that one because it became relevant during some of the debates around the Tea Party and around the Affordable Care Act. But then I go on into more modern history, and I really like the section on the 1968 Paris peace talks on Vietnam.
Oh, yes.
Because what I was able to get hold of is this remarkable material at the LBJ Library down in Austin, Texas, which shows now in great detail how Nixon tried to sabotage the peace talks, or how his campaign did, and how Johnson tried to counter it. And there's an extraordinarily interesting story about high-powered politics played out in the context of a very awful war that had already claimed 30,000 or so American lives and would go on to claim another 20-some thousand lives. So it was it was a surprise, frankly, to see to learn all that, because I think like many folks who came out of that Vietnam era, we thought of Johnson as not that serious about ending the war, but it turns out he was, but that he was essentially sabotaged.
Exactly. That was a surprise to me also. We do have to take a quick 3-minute break. We will be right back with our guest today, Robert Perry. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Robert Perry, the author of America's Stolen Narrative, From Washington and Madison to Nixon, Reagan, and the Bushes to Obama. It was published October 17th of this year. A great book. Hope you'll pick up a copy. All right, Dale, you were talking about, you mentioned Affordable Health Care Act. And then, in just a brief summary of Chapter 1, You compared it to the muskets that the government mandated that the militiamen buy, and I thought, that's right. What an early example of using the Commerce Clause.
That was not the Commerce Clause, but what it did show was that the framers, the people that put together the Constitution, had a fairly pragmatic view about the government giving orders to the population. They weren't against it. I think the important point to remember, to take away from that section, was that there has been this effort to sort of portray the framers, particularly Madison, James Madison, as someone who opposed a strong central government and favored states' rights. There are some quotes that have been taken out of one of the Federalist Papers, and of course the Tenth Amendment, which was part of the Bill of Rights that he put forward in the first Congress. However, the real history of Madison is that he and George Washington, who worked closely with him, were very much opposed to the Articles of Confederation. They were actually very much enemies of it. And the Articles of Confederation, which governed the country from 1777 to 1787, had the states as sovereign and independent. The federal government was actually not even a government. It was called a League of Friendship under the Articles. That is, it was essentially the supplicant to the states, and what the states decided in terms of money they wanted to contribute to the federal government. And Washington in particular was quite upset with all this, because as the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, he had been left often with his troops unpaid, lacking supplies, and suffering because the states decided not to contribute the money that they promised. So Washington, coming out of the Revolutionary War, had a dim view of the Articles of Confederation. And also, in those early days, some of the European powers were trying to essentially pick off some of the states and develop alliances with them, mostly commercial alliances. So Madison, who was this bright young guy in Virginia, first tried to amend the Articles, and one thing he wanted to do was to give the federal government power over interstate and national commerce, so that the Europeans could not try to exploit the differences between the states. And Washington was very much in support of that. That was beaten back, and so the next thing that Washington and Madison did is they organized, essentially in secret, an effort to get rid of the Articles altogether. And that we know as the Constitutional Convention, which was held in Philadelphia in 1787 in secret. They were supposed to simply modify the Articles, amend them. Instead, they decided to throw them out and create this new system, which had a very powerful central government, and essentially gave the states control over local matters, but gave the federal government power over printing money and controlling the interstate commerce, and having a wide range of very, very much vigorous powers to represent the United States in the world. So that's the real truth about what happened there. And the anti-federalists, and they were very strong, sounded this alarm at the time. People like Patrick Henry, who had been governor of Virginia, opposing the Constitution as this power grab by the central government. And so there were these very intense fights over the ratification in the various conventions that were set up. And Madison set them up as separate conventions. He did not want to run them through the legislatures. He thought he'd lose in the legislature, so he put them into these special ratifying conventions. And that gave the sort of the context to the Federalist Papers, which he and Hamilton and John Jay produced as sort of they were essentially propaganda documents arguing why people should vote yes for the Constitution. And in some cases, in one of the key ones, Madison tries to play down how much power he was actually giving to the federal government. And that's the one that some people now cite. They see Madison was opposed to a strong central government, but it was essentially an effort to finesse the opposition. And he makes the concession of the Tenth Amendment, which says powers that are not granted to the federal government remain with the states and the people. However, there were so many powers that were given to the federal government that was kind of a sop to the anti-federalists. And So he was able to squeeze through the Constitution very narrowly in some of the key states like New York and Virginia and Massachusetts. So what we had here was, and I think the key point I take away from all this, and I went back and studied the, went back through the Anti-Federalist Papers and the Federalist Papers and so forth. What you take away is that these guys were pragmatists. Essentially, Washington and Madison in particular were not ideologues. They were trying to figure out how to build a strong country. And it was a very, obviously, sprawling country. The 13 states had indeed fought a revolution together, but had a lot of differences in terms of what their interests were. So what you saw here was this effort to create a strong national network. And so instead of being a League of Friendship, it became the sovereignty of the country, which largely was conveyed to we the people of the United States. So the sovereignty went from the individual states to we the people. And that was a major shift. So that's, and that's sort of the background. So when people sort of look back and say, well, these guys were anti-government ideologues or they hated the federal government, it's not really true. In fact, the biggest power grab by the federal government in American history was in 1787 with the Constitutional Convention, which wiped out the Articles of Confederation and the sovereignty, the specific independence and sovereignty of the 13 states.
Right. I found that just an amazing chapter, and also your mention of the Commerce Clause and how it was used just recently in the Affordable Care Act, which and they used it because it was there and because that's what it was meant to do, is to be able to allow the federal government to force the people, the individuals, the citizens, to purchase things.
Well, there was the interesting parallel to that, to the question of what can mandates or are mandates allowed, was that in the second Congress of the United States, where indeed many of the founders actually sat, including Madison, and of course Washington was then president, they put through the so-called musket mandate, where they mandated that all military age white males had to go out and purchase or acquire muskets and shot and various accoutrements for to defend the country. So if you wonder, well, you know, would the founders, would the framers have, in their original intent, would they have been opposed to the idea of a mandate? The answer is no. I mean, they were, as I say, these were pragmatists. They weren't ideologues. And I think sometimes we now look back at this, we've sort of taken their work, which was extremely pragmatic in both good and bad ways, by the way, and tried to sort of impose almost a kind of a religious interpretation of it, that it was some kind of document passed down from on Mount Sinai or something,
right?
And it was really just it was some people trying to figure out how to make this country work, and seeing after 10 years of the Articles of Confederation that this idea of having powerful states and a weak federal government wasn't working, so they just got rid of it and they went with a whole different model, and that model did provide open-ended in some cases, like with the Commerce Clause, power for the Congress to enact legislation which would regulate interstate commerce. And even some conservative jurists, people like Lawrence Silverman, who was one of the appeals court judges who issued a ruling prior to the Supreme Court ruling, said, you know, once you've determined that health care, as we have it in the United States, is commerce and is interstate commerce, then, you know, you have to go to the language of the Constitution and what the definition of regulate was at the time, and that would have allowed the constitutionality of this legislation, the Affordable Care Act. Now, of course, the five conservative justices on the Supreme Court ruled against what Silberman and some other conservatives were saying, and they said that they didn't want the Commerce Clause to apply here. But then it was, you know, Chief Justice Roberts then went to, with the four more liberal justices, went to the taxing power of Congress, which is also very powerful, and said it could be allowed under that. But the point I'm making in this article is, or this chapter, is that if you go back to the actual intent of the framers, you see them to being not at all people who were opposed to the government taking strong action to make the country function. That was their main concern, was for the country to function effectively, especially when you consider the threats from much more developed countries of Europe, And obviously there were threats on the frontier. There were other, you know, the French were controlling or wanted to control large sections of the interior then, of what's now the United States. The British were still causing, trying to wreak some havoc. So you had, so these guys wanted to figure out how do you make this all work. And one of the things, and why the Commerce Clause was so important, Washington foresaw the need to have canals and roads and infrastructure so you could reach the interior of the nation. And one of the things he worked on, actually, in the 1780s, and then after he was president, was this Potomac Company, which was to, the idea of it was to build a canal along the Virginia side of the Potomac River. And you can still see remnants of what Washington tried to do. It ultimately was not a success, but that's what he thought was important, to sort of build the country, find ways to make it successful.
Amazing. All righty, we're going to a break. We'll be right back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Robert Perry. He is the author of America's Stolen Narrative, From Washington and Madison to Nixon, Reagan, and the Bushes to Obama. Came out October 17th. 2012. Be sure and pick up your copy. Okay, let's talk about Nixon's treason, which I found that is very fascinating. And I've been bashing Johnson for several years, saying, why did he escalate the war and then make it the last longer than it should have? And you mentioned in your book 30,000 dead Americans, and it was Nixon that we need to blame for that. For the dead people that came after that.
Right. Well, certainly Johnson miscalculated and engaged in some outrageous behavior in terms of deceiving the American people about what his goals were, and then escalating the war into a major conflict, which under his watch over 30,000 Americans died, and obviously the death toll in among the Indochinese was much higher, but. But he did. It does, and this was a surprise to me, frankly. And going back through some of this history and spending time down in Austin at the LBJ Library and reviewing some of the material that's been released in recent years, it turns out that Johnson, when he said in March of '68 that he was not going to run for re-election and spend the time he had left trying to bring the war to an end, actually meant it. Which, you know, it's always unusual when a politician says what he means, but the. But what happened, and obviously there are a lot of things that followed, including tragedies like the assassination of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, and then the messy convention that the Democrats had in Chicago. But then Hubert Humphrey was nominated to be the Democratic nominee, and Nixon was the Republican nominee. And Nixon apparently saw this possibility of a peace deal as a threat to his election. And he felt he lost very closely in 1960 and then didn't want to see that recur. So he started making contacts behind the scenes with the South Vietnamese government, setting up conduits of information, mostly through the ambassador to the United States, Huy Diem, who was also passing these messages back to President Tu in South Vietnam. And the main point was that, and this was conveyed through various intermediaries, was that Nixon would get a better deal for the South Vietnamese than Johnson would, that Johnson wanted to end the war and was going to negotiate some kind of settlement in Paris, and it was very close to being done in '68, according to these documents and some of the conversations that were recorded, phone calls between various people. So, the idea was to tell the South Vietnamese not to attend the peace talks at a crucial moment. And so in late October of 1968, the South Vietnamese reneged on an agreement to go to Paris. And that led the peace talks to collapse at that point. But what you see from these documents now, and what's really extraordinary, and also it plays into what later happened in Watergate, is that Johnson learns of Nixon's behind-the-scenes operation. And the way he learns about it is really fascinating. In sort of late October of 68, a Wall Street ally of Nixon's, whose name is sort of lost to history, but he pulls together a group of Wall Street bankers, including one who turns out to be sort of behind the scenes friendly to some of the Johnson people, and tells them that they should bet in terms of their investments on in stocks and bonds on the fact that Nixon was going to block the peace talks, that the war was going to continue. And one of the people in this little meeting then turns, provides this information to Eugene Rostow, of the who was Undersecretary of State, who passes it on to his brother, Walt Rostow, who was the National Security Advisor to Johnson. And Walt Rostow brings it into the Oval Office, just as Johnson has been learning from the U.S. Ambassador in South Vietnam that President Tu has pulled out of these peace talks. So Johnson's quite upset, and he gets this information, and then he starts ordering wiretaps to be placed on various people that that they suspect are involved in this effort to sabotage their peace talks. And they quickly learn what was happening and who was doing it and how these messages were being conveyed. And what we now know from the audio recordings that were released of Johnson talking to various people, is it even confronts Nixon. First, he confronts Senate Minority Leader Ev Dirksen, a Republican from Illinois, and says, "This is treason. What Nixon's doing is treason," Johnson says. And so Dirksen then gets Nixon to call Johnson, and Nixon assures Johnson, "Oh, I wouldn't be doing anything like that. I would never do something like that." But then Johnson keeps learning more that, in fact, it is happening. He gets more and more details. And then he has a choice. And it comes really like the day before the election in 1968. There's a Christian Science Monitor reporter, Beverly Deep, who gets the story from her South Vietnamese sources. She's in Saigon, and she files a story back to her people in the United States, and they ask their Washington bureau to check it out. And so you see the Christian Science Monitor goes to the South Vietnamese embassy, which phones are now tapped. So Johnson's hearing it from that side. But then the correspondent goes to the White House and asks Johnson, is this true? And so Johnson has to decide what to do. So it's a very interesting moment in our history.
Indeed. All righty, we're going to a 3-minute break. We'll be right back with our guest today, Robert Perry. Deanna, and our guest today is Robert Perry, the author of America's Stolen Narrative, From Washington and Madison to Nixon, Reagan, and the Bushes to Obama. Came out in October of this year. You can purchase that book from the website or from Amazon. And this is just amazing that almost twice as many Americans died as a result of Nixon's shenanigans.
Well, it's also, as I was getting to this point of Johnson had to decide what to do. I think this was another amazing part of this little narrative, was that Johnson sort of wants to go public. He wants to go to the American people and expose what Nixon's up to. But now we're like only a day or so before the election in 1968. And so Johnson has a meeting, which actually you can listen to. I have a link that goes to the Johnson Library, where they have these tape recordings. So Johnson has a meeting involving, it's a conference call involving Secretary of State Rusk, Defense Secretary Clifford, and National Security Advisor Rostow. And he's sort of saying, what should we do? And his three advisors unanimously urge them not to go public. And Clark Clifford says, in a remarkable little segment, says, you know, if we go public, it would not. And what if Nixon wins anyway? It would not be good for the country. It would be inimical to our interests to have this information out. I guess the thinking was that if the American people knew that you know, maybe too late, that Nixon had actually committed this kind of what Johnson called treason, that would have caused even more disruptions in the nation. So here was this explanation of why the American people should be denied this information, even though it was right before an election and conceivably they could have made a decision whichever way they wanted to in terms of who to elect as president. But the decision came down to stay silent. And Johnson sort of hoped, you can tell from the documents, he sort of hoped that maybe after the election, which Nixon won very narrowly, won by only less about 500,000 votes, that Nixon would then reconsider and allow the peace talks to go forward. Nixon, interestingly, in his conversation with Johnson, says, "I know how close you are to ending the war. I know we're on the edge of ending the war." So Johnson's hopeful that Nixon will relent and get the South Vietnamese to the table, and maybe he can still end the war before he leaves office in January of 69. But that doesn't happen. The boycott of the peace talks continue. Johnson grows increasingly bitter. And then he doesn't go public, but before he leaves the White House, he has Walt Rostow, his national security advisor, take the file, this file of all these transcripts of secret conversations that were wiretapped involving what Johnson called Nixon's treason. So they leave the White House with them. Walt Rostow just takes them with him when he departs on January 20th, 69. And Walt Rostow actually, he identifies this file, which he keeps in his own house apparently, as the X envelope. I'm not making this stuff up. This is really true.
Right. I found that fascinating.
He calls it the X envelope. And he keeps it, and Johnson stays sort of, he keeps his sort of word not to talk about it. But Nixon, once he's in the White House, learns from FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover that there had been these wiretaps. But Nixon now knows that the Johnson people knew a lot about what he was up to, and was very concerned that would eventually get into the public domain. It would clearly have caused him a lot of grief and might have caused him impeachment, or at least not being reelected in 72. So Nixon then orders Kissinger, his national security advisor, and his chief of staff, Bob Haldeman, to search for this file. He wants to get this file, and they can't find it. It's gone. So this goes on for a couple of years. But then in June of 71, when the New York Times begins publishing the Pentagon Papers, which is the secret history of Vietnam from 45 to 67, and mostly is about democratic deception, Nixon suddenly realizes that there's this sequel to the Pentagon Papers out there, the X envelope.
Right.
He doesn't know what is that, but that's what it is. So he then starts ordering the creation of a special team to break into at this point the Brookings Institution. They think this file is at the Brookings Institution. So Nixon then says, we've got to get E. Howard Hunt and some of these guys who know how to do this, and we've got to get them to go break into Brookings and get this file. We've got to get this file. So the formation of the Plumbers is tied to this missing file, the one that would have explained and exposed what Nixon had done to sabotage the peace talk. So it's a very fascinating story about how behind the scenes power politics actually works in America. And most Americans, I think, don't want to think these ways about, even if we're as cynical as we may have gotten over the years, I think we don't like to think that politicians would go this far, there were 500,000 American soldiers in harm's way in the war zone at the time Nixon was doing this stuff. And from that period of his presidency beginning to the time the war was finally wound down in 73, 20,000 plus died, and many more were injured. And also the war was spread into parts of Indochina, causing a great deal of human catastrophe. But power politics is an interesting thing. When you can get into this level of being able to see how it was played, and seeing how these pieces tie together, I think that it makes the book great. It's kind of an interesting contribution to American history.
Oh, absolutely. My question: why would Nixon do this? Who benefited by this these extra years of war, and why didn't he wind down the war after he was elected?
Well, because basically he thought if the war ended, if peace could be brought, if a peace deal could be struck before the election, Humphrey would have won the presidency. And that was also the view, by the way, of South Vietnamese President Nguyen Van Thieu. He thought by doing this he was helping Nixon win, which is what apparently happened. But once Nixon made this deal with the South Vietnamese, he couldn't break it. He had to go through with it, because they were in a position to say, hey, you promised us, and we did this for you, So Nixon was, in a sense, had put himself in a position where he could be coerced if he chose to cut the war off early. So he went through a period. He promises to 4 more years. He has a meeting with two in Hawaii shortly into his presidency and promises 4 more years of American military, direct military support with troops, and then another 4 years of supplies up to the South Vietnamese Army and backing in that way. So two got a better deal, in his view, a chance to actually prevail in South Vietnam and maintain his government. But if Nixon had betrayed him after cutting that deal in 68, then two could have gone public and said, hold it, Nixon gave me these promises. So Nixon had reason to extend the war. He was actually living up to his word to two.
Instead of the American people.
Yeah. That's what the historical record now shows.
Amazing. Now, would you make any comparisons to some of the promises that were made by Obama about ending the war?
Ending the war in Iraq?
Right, about bringing the troops home.
Well, I think Obama sort of said he would and ultimately did, I guess. It may have taken longer than he had indicated initially. I think he was talking about 16 months when he was running. And he instead just basically went along with the deal that that Maliki sort of imposed on Bush. Essentially, this was the Iraqis basically told Bush before he left office that the Americans have to go by the end of 2011. And so Bush agreed to that. Now, there was this expectation among some people that Obama would negotiate an extension, at least for a smaller number of troops, maybe 10,000 or so. Obama either didn't really care much to do that or just didn't or wasn't able to. And so the complete pullout occurs at the end of 2011 as scheduled. So I don't know. Obama wasn't extending the war, and there's no indication that he struck some deal with Maliki. What makes this so, offensive is what Nixon did, is that he worked, at least he had his intermediaries go behind the president's back and strike a deal with a foreign power or a foreign country, South Vietnam, in a way that undermined what the president was trying to do at that point, which was to negotiate an end to the Vietnam War. And the fact that 500,000 American soldiers were in harm's way and tens of thousands still were to die makes that very troubling. So it's not really a parallel to what I think Obama did. Obama did say he would expand the war in Afghanistan. A lot of folks thought he wasn't serious about that, and turned out that he did do it, and now is trying to bring that, I guess, in terms of winding down that war. But what Nixon did was quite extraordinary, because it would have been done when he had no power to do it. It wasn't,
exactly.
A president of the United States has constitutional authority to negotiate on behalf of the country. Some guy running for office doesn't.
Indeed. But he did anyway. And, of course, that wasn't the first time. You talk about the October surprise.
Well, that comes later in 1980 when, a similar set of circumstances arise. And that's still a little murkier, I think, in terms of the history. But there's now a substantial body of evidence and an accumulating body of evidence that some of the same people who had done this in 68 saw an opportunity in 1980 to get rid of Jimmy Carter when he was trying to negotiate the return of 52 Americans held hostage in Iran. And the evidence is now quite strong that the Republicans, some Republicans, went behind Carter's back and made their own contacts with the Iranians, and that appears to have been a factor in Carter's inability to get the hostage crisis resolved before the election in 1980. That was not a close election, however. Reagan obviously won by a pretty wide margin. And as you know, the hostages were not released until after Reagan was sworn in on January 20th of 1981. So there was always this sort of suspicion of the oddness of that timing. But over the years, especially, and this is where I sort of come in as directly reporting on these things, I was with the Associated Press in the 1980s and then later Newsweek. And the Iran-Contra scandal evolved or came up, and I was covering that for the AP in the early days. And so what we saw was that the Reagan administration, even though it claimed it would never have done so, that is, negotiate, provide weapons to Iran, was indeed doing so, that there was this secret operation that they were running, lying to the American people about. But the Iran-Contra scandal was always seen as kind of an event from like 85 to 86 when these secret shipments were made. But more and more evidence began to come to our attention as we investigated further and further into this, that the arms deals with Iran did not begin in 85, they began in 1981. And that Reagan had signed off secretly on approving shipments mostly through Israel to Iran almost immediately after coming into office. And one of those shipments was shot down or crashed over the Soviet Union in 1980, July of 81. And that was an early indication of what was actually happening behind the scenes, that there was this U.S.-sanctioned operation to let Israel provide weapons, American weapons, to the Iranians, who were then at war with the Iraqis. Later on, by 82 or so, Reagan begins to tilt toward the Iraqis because he's concerned that the Iranians are prevailing too effectively on the battlefield. So the United States ends up sort of playing both sides of that conflict, but the Israelis continue to supply the Iranian side, and that eventually evolves into what we know is the Iran-Contra shipments from 85 and 86. So what we see is a much more complicated story, a chronology, really, of a narrative going back, and then it gets us back to what happened in 1980. As I say, there are now like a couple of dozen people in positions to know, various officials from various governments, saying that, yes, some of these contacts between the Republicans, the Reagan people, and the Iranians went back to the campaign time of 1980, and the Iranians came to believe that they would get a better deal from Reagan than they would get from Carter, who they'd come to dislike quite immensely, especially after the April 1980 attempt to rescue the hostages, which of course failed. But the Iranians sort of had great disdain for Carter, and essentially threw their lot in with Reagan.
Now, was there a $10 million payoff to the Iranians for holding the hostages longer?
Well, there were a number of interesting payoffs. I don't know if I think what the Iranians got mostly was this commitment that they could get weapons that they needed.
Okay.
But there were various payoffs, and I go through this in the book. There was money that was being brought in, some of it through BCCI, which was a mysterious bank at the time, which sent money to a couple of the people involved in New York who were acting as brokers in some of these deals. And the Israelis ended up making a huge amount of money because they were being able to broker these arms sales for the Iranians. So there was a lot of money that passed through various hands. And in the book, I also traced a curious multi-million dollar investment that the Shah's sister, Princess Ashraf, makes, again involving some of these intermediaries for Reagan. They set up a bank in Hong Kong, which is essentially a fraudulent bank, and suddenly we see all this money going into this bank, which one of Reagan's Republican intermediaries is sort of in control of, and the bank ultimately goes belly up and lots of money disappears. So there were many mysterious payments that sort of surround this historical mystery of what's now known as the October Surprise mystery of 1980. But the evidence is, as I say, quite strong that that indeed the Republicans did make these overtures behind Carter's back, and some of them were successful in terms of getting the Iranians to cooperate with them, not with Carter.
Amazing how this has all played out over the years. It just seems now the Israelis are against the Iranians, and it's just like it's musical chairs.
Well, the Israelis, as you probably know, were very close to the Iranians prior, while the Shah was in power. Mm-hmm. And the Israelis considered what they called the periphery strategy, which included trying to have countries that weren't Arab countries in the region ally with them. And after the revolution in 79, they sought to rebuild those ties.
Right. All righty, we're going to a quick 3-minute break. We will be right back. Our guest today is Robert Perry, the author of America's Stolen Narrative, From Washington and Madison to Nixon, Reagan and the Bushes to Obama. Came out on October 17th, 2012. He's also written other books. I love your work. I have all of your books except one, I believe. But I really also appreciate the news coverage that you give to Consortium. And you have had that website since 1995, is that correct?
Right. Basically, it was the first sort of investigative news magazine, if you will, on the Internet, because back in 95 there wasn't a lot on the Internet. There were some chat rooms and things of that sort, but not really much in the way of independent publications for the Internet. We were based there. But it started because after I'd worked at AP Newsweek, PBS Frontline. By the time you get to the early to mid 90s, a lot of documents are now available, are coming on. Basically, I'm able to access a number of documents pertaining to the mysteries of the 1980s, which mostly had been sort of covered up or they've been inconclusive in terms of various investigations. But no one was interested in them in the 1990s because by then we're into the Clinton years and there were various Clinton issues like his sex life and so forth that people thought was more interesting. So I was having trouble finding a place to write any of these stories. And my oldest son, Sam, who just graduated from college then, hears me complaining about this one day and says, you know, Dad, there's this thing called the Internet, you know. And I really didn't know. I mean, I knew there'd been something called the Internet, but I hadn't really dealt with it. So Sam, who wasn't really any kind of technical expert or anything, but he learns how to build a website. And we started, it was kind of crude initially, but it was a way to get these documents out and stories about the documents out. And so we started that in basically November, December of 1995. And we're able to put out a number of very interesting stories, and it's grown in sort of fits and starts. We've had times where we've sort of run out of money, basically, but we've tried to keep it going, and other times we get a little bit of money and we're able to do more. So, but we've kept it going for the last, we've just passed our 17th year, I guess, heading into our 18th. So it has a lot of history there that's been collected. And, you know, one of the other curious things, Deanna, that kind of surprised me. We set this up really with the idea that it would be a way for journalists to write things that were good, solid journalism, but had sort of were no longer really welcome in the more trivial media that we were seeing in the 1990s. But over the years, we ended up with a number of former CIA analysts writing for us. And what I sort of learned, somewhat to my surprise, was that while the American journalists who were trying to do honest work in that period were under a lot of pressure not to, there was a parallel thing going on inside the U.S. intelligence community, where the intelligence analysis was being politicized, and people were being pushed out of the CIA for basically telling unpleasant or undesired truths, and so a number of those folks have started submitting stories to us, and so we have a interesting mix of journalists and ex-CIA people writing at the website.
Very interesting. All righty, we're going to take our 60-second top of the hour break. We will be right back with our guest today, Robert Perry. Welcome back. This is the second hour of Spingola Speaks. This is Deanna Spingola. Our guest today is Robert Perry, the author of America's Stolen Narrative, From Washington and Madison to Nixon, Reagan and the Bushes to Obama. It came out on October 17th of this year. He is also the author of Lost History, Contras, Cocaine, The Press, and Project Truth. It came out in 99. Secrecy and Privilege, Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq, came out in 2004, and Neck Deep, The Disastrous Presidency of George W. Bush And he wrote that with his two sons, Sam and Nat, and that came out in 2007. Now, we might think, well, why would anybody want to know about the Bush dynasty or what happened during those administrations? But I think that history, even recent history, is very essential so that we can determine what is going on now. The website is consortiumnews.com. You can sign up to receive email, a daily email from the website. Just type your email in. Robert, what stories have you been covering lately? I know you were up in Canada recently.
Yes. Well, that was a curious one, I must say. But there was this Israeli intelligence officer named Ari Ben-Menashe, who I had first encountered. I first heard his name during the Iran-Contra period. He was one of the Israelis handling some of the arms shipments to Iran during that time frame. And he was sort of he'd been kind of a mystery man on the sort of the edges of the Iran-Contra scandal as it was evolving. And I never could locate him until he got arrested in the United States for involvement in a military sale to Iran, and going to be put on trial in 1990. And basically, the Israeli government, even though he was working for them, decided to abandon him largely. They decided not to help him out and told him basically to just plead guilty and then we'll get you out. And he refused to plead guilty and fought the charges. And he also, at that point, began talking. And I met him in early 1990. I was with Newsweek at the time. At the federal prison in Lower Manhattan, where he was being held, and he was a very brash guy. I mean, it's sort of odd to find that. Usually, often people in prison aren't quite that brash, but he was a star Israeli intelligence officer, and he offered me a very different version of Iran-Contra than I was familiar with. He had much more interesting chapters that I had never gotten into. But first I had to check out who he was. The Israeli government said, oh, he's just an imposter. You don't believe anything he says. But I was able to obtain Israeli government records, letters of reference for him, basically, that showed that he had indeed worked for more than a decade for Israeli intelligence, for a branch of the IDF. And that he'd handled sensitive assignments for them. And so I went back to the Israelis and said, what are you doing? Why'd you lie to us? And they said, oh, well, he did work for us, but he was not that important. And they began a sort of a campaign with the journalists who were friendly to Israel to sort of tear this guy down, because he really had a lot of sensitive information about Israel that he was beginning to talk about. Over the years, I've dealt with him. He's a bit problematic in that he can be a little bit high-handed. He's not a particularly easy person to deal with. But he provided a lot of very useful and accurate information about some very sensitive areas. Cy Hirsch used him as a source in the Samson option. He provided information about the Israeli nuclear program, which obviously is a highly sensitive thing for the Israelis. His house was firebombed a week ago. I'm in Canada, so I went up to Montreal to investigate as best I could.
Right. All righty. We'll be right back with our guest after a 3-minute break. Word from our sponsors. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Robert Perry. Okay, so Ben-Menashe was in jail and then got out of jail and decided to go to Canada. Why do you think he went to Canada instead of staying?
There were a few things in between, but he was tried in fall of 1990 in federal court, and he was, and the jury found him not guilty. Some of the same documents that I had gotten hold of, they were used there to show that indeed he was working for the Israeli government. He wasn't just some freelance arms dealer, which is how he's being presented by the U.S. government at that point. So he was acquitted, and he then went to Australia for a while. But he also was providing information to members of Congress and to other investigators and to the press. So he had some troubles with the Israelis. They tried to really get him capture him and bring him back, much like they did with Mordecai Vanunu, who was another whistleblower in the mid-'80s who exposed the nuclear program, and then he was kidnapped in Rome and taken to Israel and prosecuted for revealing state secrets and imprisoned for 18 years. So Ben-Menashe basically was able to avoid that fate, in part by cooperating with some investigations, but he always was a bit of a controversial figure. He was under a lot of criticism from journalists, especially those who were close to Israel or supportive of Israel, because he was being so disparaged by Israel. So eventually he just kind of figured out how to build his life again, and he moved to Canada, married a Canadian woman, got citizenship, and was involved with, and is now sort of running a kind of a international consulting firm where he deals with a lot of international hotspots and somewhat cooperates with various intelligence services. He provided information to the Canadian intelligence, for instance, on topics they might be interested in Africa and places where Ben-Menashe was working. So that's been his case, but he recontacted me, last Monday, a week ago, he was supposed to come to Washington, and he was going to bring with him a senior Israeli intelligence officer who wanted to sort of provide information to me about some historical things I'd been interested in.
Really?
On Sunday night, a week ago Sunday, someone threw a very sophisticated firebomb into Ben-Menashe's house in Montreal, and it very rapidly consumed the whole house. The police are investigating exactly what kind of accelerant was used, but it was apparently a very powerful one. And Ben-Menashe and his girlfriend were able to escape. She first tried to put the fire out with water, but it was out of control. And where they were able to flee the house, which was completely destroyed. It also destroyed many of Ben-Menashe's personal records, passports, and so forth. And it also scared off, apparently, this Israeli official who was preparing to come down here on a week ago Monday. So that was in the context of why I went up, to sort of see what actually had happened. So I went up to Montreal and was able to learn some things about what had happened, although the police are being pretty tight-lipped about exactly what they've been discovering so far. But it's not clear who did it. There are a lot of potential suspects, because Ben-Menashe has been dealing in a lot of controversial areas, conflict zones, especially in Africa, and he's been working with providing information and assistance to various governments. That kind of work can breed you enemies, and so there are plenty of possible suspects.
Now, were they trying to kill him, or do you think they were just trying to scare him a little bit?
Well, the house went up so quickly in flames that it clearly could have killed him. The attack occurred about 9:30 at night. Obviously, if you wanted to really kill somebody, if you wanted to maximize your chances of killing them, you might have waited till 2 in the morning.
3 in the morning, yeah.
And when no one's awake, and the smoke and the inhalation would get you even as perhaps even faster than the fire. But it certainly was a devastating blow to him, in the sense that a lot of his documents, including things that he thought he was willing to, he was also offering to share with me, disappeared in the fire, and they're not things that can be easily recovered. When I was up there, I did talk to him and the woman who was in the house with him, he's planning to make a trip to Russia. He does some work for the Russian government, is a consultant, and he needed to get his passport back, and he also had a Russian passport that he'd been provided, so he needed to get that again, and so it sort of messed up his life, but it also messed up the chance for him coming down here with that Israeli intelligence official, who apparently concluded immediately that it might have been that the Israelis might have been behind it, but we don't know that for any kind of fact at this point.
Well, they would certainly have a reason to want to shut him up.
Right. He's provided a lot of information which they just assume not have be public. And maybe in some ways, the fact that he cooperated with Cy Hirsch on the book The Samson Option back in the 90s and went into sort of the more current status of, at that time, the more current status of the Israeli nuclear program was certainly something that made him an enemy of the state as far as many Israeli government officials would be concerned. And there was this apparently an effort in around 91 to sort of get him deported when he was in the United States to Israel. But some members of Congress who wanted to interview Ben-Menashe intervened and prevented the then Bush one administration from sending him back to Israel, where he would have been prosecuted and silenced pretty much for good. So anyway, it's an interesting, it's another mystery and sort of on top of a mystery, I suppose, but it is remarkable to actually see what a firebomb can do to someone's life. It's, especially one like this, because it burned pretty much everything, and ultimately, pretty much everything he had was destroyed.
And he didn't have records anywhere else except in his home.
Well, he had some records in his office, but there were some records that he had in his briefcase that he didn't have anywhere else, like, you know, his passports and things of that sort.
Sure.
And his passport, not only his current one, but also ones that go back over the years. And I've seen those passports. He's shown them to me at different times. So like, if I was trying to figure out when he might have been doing something, he could say, well, this is the, you know, passport stamp when I was entering this country. And, you know, so it was obviously very useful historically to sort of set up, if you're trying to check out what he's saying and need some kind of chronology to do so, those kinds of records are invaluable.
Right. Now, he is also the individual that was helping the Republicans in brokering the deal with Iran's Islamic regime back
right.
in 1980.
Right. Part of his testimony, and he's done this under oath in several cases, was that he was one of the young Israeli intelligence officers assigned to help the Republicans make the contacts with Iran. Now, Ben-Menashe's history is that he's an Iraqi Jew who was born in Tehran, Iran, and sort of grew up there. His father ran a Mercedes dealership. And Ben-Menashe then emigrates to Israel in his teenage years, about 16, and his family then later comes and joins him. He goes into the military, and ultimately into the intelligence service, because he speaks Farsi and because he has friends who were rising inside Iran after the revolution in 79. He becomes a person that the Israelis see as a useful, fairly important intelligence officer who can help them rebuild their ties to Iran, which is very important to Israel. Because it was a way to sort of counter some of the Arab pressure on Israel. So that's what he gets assigned to do. And as part of that, he says, he was part of a team of Israeli intelligence people that went to these meetings in Paris in which key Republicans met with Iranians regarding how to set up arms deals once Reagan took office in 1981. And part of that was to make sure the hostages were not released prior to the election in 1980, and then ultimately not till Reagan was sworn in January 20th, 81. So he's provided that evidence. It's obviously a controversial point. Some people have attacked it and claimed it's not true, but there's also substantial evidence to support it. And that's always been sort of the part of the murky element of Ben-Menashe, and one of the reasons his credibility has been so aggressively attacked, because he provides information that would be creates a great deal of discomfort for some very powerful people. But he's always stuck to his story. He's always insisted that that was indeed the case. And frankly, I've been able to develop some evidence to support much of what he said. I've not been able to really disprove any substantive point of what he said, although I've tried hard. It remains somewhat of an open question. And I was hoping to get it resolved this last week, but then his house burns. His house is firebombed and burns to the ground.
I think that's a pretty significant occurrence.
Well, we'll see. You know, it's always you never. You know, I certainly hope the Montreal police do a thorough investigation of it. I was there when the head of the arson squad was collecting samples, sort of CSI type stuff. You know, from they pull away the wreckage. The house had to be torn down because it was such a wreck, and then they go through with one of those long claws from a mechanical device, and they pull away the substance and go down to where the accelerant landed and try to get samples of it.
Right. And then maybe they could figure out where the accelerant came from.
Right. If it's a sophisticated accelerant, they might be able to trace it to a manufacturer. Yeah.
Sure. All righty. We are taking a break. We will take your calls when we come back at 800-313-9443. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Robert Perry. The website is consortiumnews.com. And why don't we go ahead and take a call, and then I would like to have you talk about the anniversary of Gary Webb's death. You reprint an article, which you did yesterday, and so maybe we could cover that. But let's take a call from Richard in Washington. Richard, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Great guest for a question that I've always wanted to ask. My belief is that most of history since before Roosevelt is written by intelligence agencies with the help of bureaucratic middlemen, that the presidents are just kind of mouthpieces or figureheads for actually what history is going to be. What's your take on that?
Well, that's an interesting point. I think from what I've been able to ascertain from going through many of these old records, the presidents actually are more players than that. Clearly, there's a tension between any president and the establishment, if you will, people with financial and other interests that bear on how the U.S. government does its business, and they can be in conflict. But the presidents have their own independent power to a great extent, and to some degree, they've been able to bend the intelligence community to their will. For instance, a lot of what I write about deals with President Reagan. And one thing President Reagan did was he brought in this group of very smart, ambitious, aggressive ideologues known as the neoconservatives. And so they were very attuned to the idea of how you manipulate the American people. They did what they called, they had a phrase for it called perception management. And so they spent a lot of time and effort in the early to mid-80s trying to figure out how they could basically package propaganda for the American public, especially on Central America, but on some other topics as well. Part of that was to go into the CIA and politicize the intelligence directorate of the CIA, the people that did the analysis. And we saw during that period the agency basically be turned into more of a propaganda shop. But it was sort of in line with what some of these people in the Reagan administration wanted. So what I see is that sometimes the political figures do have extraordinary bureaucratic power that they can impose on the intelligence community. And I'm not saying it doesn't go vice versa sometimes, but what I've seen mostly goes from the White House to the CIA, not vice versa.
And how do you feel about Carol Quigley's hidden hand? Do you think there's a hidden hand that controls both kind of the background of the White House and the investigative intelligence agencies?
Well, there's no question that some people with money wield still enormous power. And part of in the book America's Stolen Narrative, I go into the role of David Rockefeller, for instance, because he plays a big role in the dealings with Iran, because he was the Shah's banker, and Chase Manhattan stood to lose billions of dollars at the time of that revolution. So Rockefeller, he writes about this some in his memoirs, he gets in there and tries to shape how the Carter administration handles the issue of the Shah, and they want to bring the Shah into the United States for medical treatment and so forth. Carter resists. There's an interesting confrontation between where Rockefeller goes into the Oval Office and essentially tells Carter, you must do this, and Carter kind of loses his cool and throws Rockefeller out. But Rockefeller then prevails ultimately. He pressures Carter into allowing the Shah in, and that's what touches off the hostage crisis in Iran. So what you see is that even when presidents want to resist that or want to resist a specific desire on the part of someone as powerful and wealthy as someone like Rockefeller, they can be bent to the will of the, of that powerful person. And so you do see that. Now, but I see it more as individual cases, not – I'm not sure I know enough to sort of give you a broad analysis of yeah, that happens all the time, or because I tend to look at stories as individual stories and individual facts and try to just look at case studies, not make that broader analysis that you're referring to. But certainly that happens, whether it happens all the time or part of the time, I really can't give you an overview.
Well, the one that kind of amazed me was Douglas Dietrich, the librarian, his presentation where he said that most of the foreign policy in the Roosevelt administration was undertaken by a non-American kind of created the situation that got us into as far as World War II and Pearl Harbor, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm not familiar with that work, so I'm sorry.
Have you read The Parable of the Tribes by Andrew Schmuckler?
No, I haven't.
I would recommend that Diane get this gentleman. It seems to be this guy has got a real good presentation. Thank you much for the input.
Thank you.
Thanks, Richard. All righty. If you have a comment or question, the number is 800-313-9443. Well, it's interesting because I think that Rockefeller and Brzezinski had a
right.
lot of influence in getting Carter elected. And apparently Carter wasn't going to play the game.
Well, Carter, I think, thought he was president and thought he didn't, you know, he could, you know, sort of that always that tension we've seen going back a number of years where some presidents don't want to have a J.P. Morgan, like happened with Teddy Roosevelt, where J.P. Morgan comes in and says, here's what we're going to do. And Teddy Roosevelt is reported to said, you know, I'm the president of the United States. I'm elected by all the people. I don't have to listen to you. But there is that sort of pressure that's real.
Sure. All righty. We're going to a 3-minute break. And a word from our sponsor. We'll be right back with our guest today, Robert Perry. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Robert Perry. Now, certainly the Reagan administration disabled the Fairness Doctrine and put a real right-wing slant on the news and brought in a lot of the neocons, and they're still here. They're still around. Still controlling things.
Yeah, the neocons have proven to be a very powerful element of official Washington, and I think it's, of all the things that you may criticize about the Reagan years, I think his credentialing these guys has been quite dangerous to the whole United States. They are ideologues. They don't really believe in democracy as you and I would think of it, in that having an informed electorate deciding, giving, you know, instructions through elections and other means to the politicians. The neocons are people who believe that they are essentially kind of a vanguard party almost. It's almost as if there's an element of ultra leftism that sort of comes in with the neocons, some of who sort of emerged from the Trotskyite movement many years ago.
Right.
And so you have this sort of, they're the vanguard party, they know best. They have to manipulate the rest of us, make sure we don't get information that might undermine their interest and where they want to take us, and then they sort of herd us like cattle. That's kind of their view. They're the smart ones. We're the dumb ones, and that has of course led to some very I think destructive actions on the part of for the American people, and obviously the Iraq War being one of them, which was a sort of a neocon war of choice that they. Sold to us on essentially false circumstances, and led to, you know, again, a lot of American blood being shed for no particular ultimate good. I mean, Saddam Hussein was removed, but now we have sort of, instead of a Sunni dictatorship running Iraq, it's now a sort of a Shiite semi-dictatorship running Iraq, and it's allying itself with Iran, which is not exactly a friend of the United States at this point either. So there doesn't seem to have been a lot gained for all the hundreds of billions of dollars spent and the nearly 4,500 American soldiers who were killed and many more, of course, wounded, 30,000 or so. So, you know, I think the neocons have remained very influential in Washington despite their record. And it just shows how well-funded they are and how much they've dug in to the whole Washington establishment and become part of it.
Right. All the while claiming that the media is liberal.
Well, I guess that's been part of the theme from some on the right for a long time. It's just not true. I mean, I worked in I worked at the Associated Press, Newsweek, and PBS, and so I have many friends who work at other major publications. And what you really see is essentially the people that run most of these companies, not all, but most of them, they tend to be Republican and conservative. At the AP, the guy who was the general manager when I was there, Keith Fuller, was a strong supporter of Ronald Reagan and made it clear he was. So it made it very hard to report stories that might put Reagan in a bad light, which was always a tension that I faced covering the Iran-Contra stuff. At Newsweek, it was sort of more of a neoconservative bent. The Graham family was, which owned the Washington Post as well as Newsweek, they've become sort of neoconservatives. So that's the kind of reflection they have in there. It's not liberal. If you read the Washington Post editorial pages, for instance, what you see is just, you know, one neocon column after another, and that's where their editorial page is too. They were very supportive of the Iraq War and things like that. So this idea that there's this liberal press is it's always been a myth. Historically, of course, the press has been mostly Republican because it reflected the wealthier people that were able to own newspapers. And that really hasn't changed too much. Obviously, there are exceptions. There are entities that are more liberal, and so it's not monolithic. But generally speaking, the idea that the press has this deep-seated liberal bias just isn't true.
I think Bill Kristol even admitted to that at one point.
Well, Kristol is a neocon, but he's a very smart guy and cares somewhat about being seen as somewhat credible. And yes, I mean, I think anyone who looks at this objectively and sees how this has played out over the last 30, 40 years in particular would have to say that the press the larger media in general has tilted pretty much to the right. It's certainly true mostly of talk radio. After the Fairness Doctrine was sort of knocked out in the 80s, we've seen a rise of mostly right-wing talk radio. There are a few liberal entities, but not many. Fox News obviously became an important element in the mid-90s, dominating the cable networks. MSNBC, which is now considered the sort of the liberal alternative, but NBC only did that because they tried to be more like Fox than Fox. If you watched NBC during the Iraq War, for instance, they were as jingoistic and supportive of the war as Fox, maybe even more so. But Fox had sort of cornered that side of the market. So for money reasons, ratings reasons, and NBC kind of said, well, we'll try some of this. We'll try Keith Olbermann and some of this liberal stuff. And that sort of has worked out for them. So they've kept it up. But that's just a dollars and cents kind of decision, not one of ideology. If you watch CNBC, for instance, that tilts very much to the right. So, I think what you see is a generally a right of center bent with the media, but there are exceptions.
Right. All right. So, talk to us about Gary Webb, and you did, as I mentioned, repost this article from the archives. It was originally published December 9th of 2011. For those listeners who do not know who he is or what happened or what he did.
Well, Gary Webb was a reporter for the San Jose Mercury News, and he essentially in the 1990s revived the story of the Contra drug operation. In the 1980s, there was this war in Central America between the Nicaraguan leftist government, Sandinistas, and the Contras, who were supported by the Central Intelligence Agency and the Reagan administration. Now, what happened is that the Contras were involved with drug traffickers really throughout their existence, going back to 1980, even before Reagan came in. The early Contras were involved with various drug dealers, and that continued through the decade of that war. At the Associated Press in 85, Brian Barger and I, two correspondents, wrote the first story about the Contras being involved in drug trafficking, and it was a controversial story, but we had it very well backed up at that point. That led to an investigation that Senator Kerry led in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which further showed this problem. But it was always kind of dismissed and attacked. It was never accepted by the mainstream of the Washington press corps. Then it kind of disappeared as a story for a long time. But then Gary Webb in 1996 revived it because he came up with evidence that some of those Contra cocaine shipments had fed into the crack epidemic that devastated Los Angeles and other American cities in that time frame. He was then his story was, you know, pretty well backed up too, but he came under a pretty fierce attack from not just from some elements of the political system, but also from news organizations like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times, which had essentially missed the story back in the 80s. They were part of the effort to sort of they were when we were writing this up for the AP back in that time frame. Those newspapers, which were under a lot of pressure from the Reagan administration not to go in these directions, kind of joined in sort of dumping on the story. So here's more evidence coming in, and it was coming in from the San Jose Mercury News, which was paper that was not considered a major newspaper. It was off in California and Silicon Valley, and so there was a lot of internal news rivalry going on, as well as these big papers not wanting to admit they'd missed a big story a decade earlier. And so Gary Webb was trashed, laughed at, ridiculed. It was quite ugly. At consortiumnews.com, we were one of the few places that were saying, hold it, you know, why is this going on? Webb's on to something that's important. And what Webb was able to do was to get some investigations going that, frankly, I was not able to do back in the 80s, where the CIA began to look internally at itself through the Inspector General. And the CIA did a pretty honest job. The Inspector General, Frederick Hitz, was a man of integrity and actually began disclosing that, in fact, there was a bigger problem with Contra drug trafficking than the Reagan administration had wanted to admit to back in the 80s. However, Webb was already been so ridiculed, he was sort of forced out of his job at the San Jose Mercury News, which kind of turned on him under all this pressure. And he was sort of cut adrift. And he found some job with the state of California for a while, but that disappeared. And then, you know, his marriage broke up, a lot of things happened that weren't very pretty, and he was ultimately about to be kicked out of some rental property he was living in Sacramento in December of 2004, and instead chose to kill himself with his father's revolver. And so afterwards, I got a call from the LA Times, which said, you know, they wanted to interview me about it. And I said, listen, you know, the history owes Gary Webb a great debt, but you guys aren't going to be able to acknowledge it because you've never admitted it, because the LA Times had never even reported on what the CIA ultimately confessed to, which was a pretty remarkable report, but it was largely ignored because it went against what these news organizations had sort of been reporting for a decade. And so when the CIA confessed to much of this stuff, not that what the CIA confessed to was that they looked the other way, they helped cover up for the Contra drug traffickers because they needed them to fight this war. The CIA didn't admit to being involved in the drug trafficking per se, right? So, but that's still pretty bad, what the CIA confessed to. The trashing of Gary Webb just continued, even after his death. So I began to, I wrote a piece at that time, and then on the anniversary of his death, I went back and reviewed some of the material and what it kind of meant and why the press acted the way it acted. You know, yesterday was the anniversary of his death again, so I republished one of my earlier stories that was fairly lengthy and goes into what happened to the news media and why the news media behaved this way, but also goes back to what the CIA confessed to, which is really important history. And, you know, and we have to get these things straight finally. You know, we end up with this kind of murky, we're not sure what to believe anymore, but sometimes... And sometimes that's is the way it is because things are confusing, but other times the record is clear. And the historical record needs to be laid out sometimes. And in this case, we have even the CIA laying it out for us. And the Justice Department, too, by the way, when they did internal investigations. And it's just that people ignored them. This was back in the 90s, and people just, the journalists did not want to go back and revisit that story. So I do. And I think it's an important point for people to understand what's happened both to their country and to the government agencies that represent them, but also what's happened in the major news organization and how they stopped doing their jobs right. And that's what I encountered when I was both in them at Newsweek in particular, but also what I've seen since then. And the treatment of Gary Webb was just one of the most egregious acts of malfeasance on the part of the American press corps that I can think of. They turned on one of their own because he was essentially embarrassing them by bringing out information that they had poo-pooed or laughed at earlier and now didn't want to admit. So I think that's why it's an important lesson that it's an important story for people to know.
Oh, I totally agree with you. Do you think that he actually did kill himself, or do you think that he was murdered?
Oh, I think it was pretty clear he committed suicide. He wrote letters, notes to his kids and to his ex-wife. He'd gotten his cremation certificate, which he laid out, used his father's revolver. And I also talked to his family. There was all kinds of financial pressures on him. His marriage had broken up. There was child support problems. He'd been trying to get jobs at any kind of newspaper he could. But because he'd been sort of stigmatized in the way he'd been stigmatized, he couldn't even get a job at some paper that should have, been thrilled to even have him apply. And I think he just saw no way out. And I think, frankly, some people want to sort of make it into a murder, but there's no evidence of that. The evidence is that he killed himself. But I think there's also sort of I think if one understands that this didn't have to happen, I think that there's a certain amount of guilt on the part of all of us who could have maybe helped someone like Webb pretty easily and for various reasons didn't. I was actually going to offer him something, but at that point we had no money in our operation, and I didn't realize he was so desperate. I'd lost touch with him, but I'd been thinking about recontacting him in 2004, but I wasn't able to pull together the resources I'd hoped to pull together, and so I just had to delay it, and then I didn't know that he was where he was. So, but frankly, someone like Gary Webb should not have been put in that position. He was too valuable. He'd done too many good things, too many important things for the country, and the fact that this country, a country as rich as we are, left a person like that hanging out there, it's a disgrace for the American profession of journalism.
Indeed,
but others of us could have helped and. Various reasons, money wasn't available to help him out, and it's a tragedy. But it's something we all should learn from, and we also should realize that sometimes we owe debts to people who dig out parts of our history, and then are abused for having done so. But
do you think
we all benefit from
sir,
that history?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
But no, I think I was saying we all benefit from the history that they dig up.
Right. Do you think the incident? Excuse me. His experience stands as a model to others. What might happen to them if they print too much truth?
Well, I think it has done that. I think people are afraid to go into certain stories because they, obviously there are crazy conspiracies out there that aren't worth really spending much time at, but there are some real serious conspiracies that are. But people know that if they turn over certain rocks and pursue certain lines of inquiry, whether you're a politician, whether you're a government official, whether you're a journalist, that the consequences can be very devastating for you. That you will may lose your job, you may lose your promotion, you may lose things your livelihood. And Gary Webb was an example of that. There was no reason, except sort of professional cowardice, that led the San Jose Mercury News to punish him the way they did.
Right.
But that is a lesson that we all have to take to heart, that we run those risks if we do hard stories.
Sure. All righty, we're going to a 3-minute break. We will be right back, and we will take a call. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today has been Robert Perry, the author of many, many interesting books. That website is consortiumnews.com. Please go there. Leave a little money, leave a donation, sign up for the email list, and we do have a caller. Let's take Sherry in Kansas. Sherry, welcome to the program.
Hi, Deanna. Mr. Perry, it's been a fascinating interview. My comment is that I think that the media, whether they be print or audio or video, that they are more constrained by advertising money and also monetary issues such as, well, we know the banks are laundering drug money and stuff like that, and, you know, the kind of things that Catherine Austin Fitz has exposed. And so, you know, I wouldn't call it right and left so much as maybe corporations are running America now instead of the people. Do you have any indication whether Stanfield Turner was actually trying to clean up the CIA during the Carter administration?
Well, first of all, I sort of agree with your first point. I think the corporate side of this is very important to understand, as well as there is some ideological components and personal stuff. Sometimes publishers like a Katharine Graham like certain people or dislike certain people. So you always have to factor in also that kind of that personal level too. But getting to your to the question about Stanfield Turner, who I do know, I think Turner was trying to bring the CIA somewhat under control, certainly downsizing it after the Vietnam War. He did sort of push out some of the more some people involved in some of the dirtier aspects of the agency, and that also was a factor in what happened, I think, in 1980. You have to remember that there were key elements of the CIA that liked George H.W. Bush a lot. He'd been the former director, remember, before Turner, and they didn't like what Carter was doing to the agency, and so some of them were either pushed out or left, and they joined up with the Bush campaign initially in '80, and then when Bush became the vice presidential nominee with Reagan, they switched over to Reagan's campaign. So you had people like a Ted Shackley, who'd been head of the clandestine services, and many of his operatives, some of whom remained in the CIA, as well as people who were outside it, who were then sort of working against Carter's reelection, which they feared terribly. So, yes, I do think that Turner was doing some things. I don't think he was particularly the most aggressive person in this way, but he was taking steps, and I think he's basically was an honest man from my dealings with him.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for your call, Sherry. Well, it has certainly been very interesting having you on the program today. I hope that you will come back, and I really, really like your books, and it's a lot of interesting things in your most recent book, America's Stolen Narrative, From Washington and Madison to Nixon, Reagan and the Bushes to Obama. Now, has this book been received quite well? I know it's only been out for a short time.
Well, it hasn't really been reviewed by any of the major places, but people who have read it have said they like it, so, which I guess is probably more important sometimes than some of the professional reviewers.
Indeed. Well, I certainly appreciate it, like it very much. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Diana.
All righty. Bye-bye.